I don't know. We'll find out. But if you're going to win this race, you can't sit back, and they're not going to hand it over to you.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else the Iditarod and hanging on for dear life. I'm your host, Casey Grove, hanging out here with you today. And the Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM. That was our current 2023 Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race leader, Ryan Reddington, off the top. Before we hop back on the runners and head on down the trail, let's hand it off to the folks who help us pay for this coverage.
Hi, I'm Holly with Alaska Public Media's marketing team. Calling all fans of the Iditapod, for a limited time only, you can receive an Iditapod sticker as a thank you gift when you donate online. Visit alaskapublic.org/Iditarod to support us today and keep your public media thriving. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Holly. Happy Monday, everybody. Iditarod teams are well into the coastal stretches of the race today, having reached the Bering Sea coast Sunday morning. We'll hear more in this episode from Ryan Reddington when he was just reaching the coast there in Unalakleet. That's the largest community on the trail itself between the start in Willow and the finish line in Nome, that famed burled arch that represents the end of this 1,000-mile journey. We'll also hear more about how one rookie musher's dreams of reaching the finish were almost derailed after he fell off his sled and lost his dog team. Then we have a listener question and answers from several mushers about some things that they've lost along the way. And if you're missing any sled dogs, don't worry. We have not one, but two dogs of the day today. Back to Ryan Reddington at the front of the pack. After mushing into and out of Elam at race mile 875 this morning, he had been trailed pretty closely by Pete Kaiser, the 2019 Iditarod champ and the last one to win it on this full southern route. In fact, looking at the checkpoint times, at least their times leaving the checkpoints, those two have been separated by less than an hour, in some cases only 15 or 20 minutes since way back in Grayling, about 350, 400 miles ago. Richie Deal and his team had been right there too with Reddington and Kaiser, but he's dropped back a little ways, still holding down third place at the moment though. Notably, the top three mushers in the Iditarod right now are all Alaska Native guys, two of whom are based off the road system in the Yukon-Kuskokwim region, that's Kaiser and Deal. And on that duel between the two at the front, Reddington and Kaiser, the folks at Iditarod Insider were speculating yesterday about things that Kaiser could do to either catch up to Reddington or even some mind games that he could play, mushing through certain checkpoints or stopping to rest at places that Reddington would not expect. That doesn't seem to be Pete Kaiser's style, but who knows? He had been hanging right with Reddington, but seems to be resting in Elam longer than Reddington, who just blew through. So I'm wondering if Pete Kaiser is maybe setting himself up to slingshot past Reddington on the way to White Mountain, or if Kaiser's just kind of thinking, well, I need to rest my team and just make it to White Mountain to hold on to second place. White Mountain, of course, is where mushers take a mandatory 8-hour break, so they're well rested for the final 77 miles to Nome. And if the team at the front has enough of a lead, it's usually pretty well locked up at that point. But not always, so we shall see. There have definitely been teams knocked out of the race in the final stretches, including, as I tell this story often, the 2014 race when Jeff King was well out in front but then had to scratch because of a huge windstorm that hit him. I don't want to try to guess what the weather is going to be like right in that specific section. They call it the blowhole because the wind blows pretty hard. But looking at the forecast for that general area, they're expecting a little bit of snow, but the winds are not expected to be too bad for the next few days. It looks like 5 to 15 miles an hour, up to maybe 20, 25 miles per hour by Tuesday night. Maybe a little chilly, lows around 10 below zero, but even 25 mile per hour winds are not bad for that region. And it has been even calmer, actually, leading up to today. As Bruce Lee with the Iditarod Insider put it, if you were standing out on the sea ice yesterday and you dropped a feather, it would land on your boot, which I thought was a nice way of describing it, even if that is uncommonly calm. So yeah, at the moment, Ryan Reddington in first, Pete Kaiser in second, as I'm recording this, still resting in Elam. Richie Deal is on his way to Elam still. A little bit farther back in fourth place is Matt Hall, who, if he can hang on to that position, that would be his highest finish in the Iditarod. But Hall is trailed very closely by Kelly Maxner. A ways back, you have Jesse Holmes and Millie Porcelt out of Koyuk, and still in Koyuk, In 8th place, Matt Failer. 9th place, Eddie Burke Jr., still the top rookie in this year's race. And only about an hour and 15 minutes or so behind is Hunter Keefe to round out the top 10. This, of course, is after all those teams crossed the sea ice of Golovin Bay between Shaktuluk and Koyuk. They had reached the Bering Sea coast on Sunday. Again, Ryan Reddington was the first into Unalakleet there at the coast after a monster run that had put at least some distance between him and his rivals. Alaska Public Media's Ben Matheson was in UNC, as we like to call it, and has more from Reddington and the tight race at the front of the pack.
Ryan Reddington was the first Iditarod musher to reach Unalakleet after running the 85-mile Portage Trail from Kaltag nonstop.
Hi, how are you?
The move gave him a clear, if precarious, advantage over his closest competitors, Pete Kaiser and Richie Deal. Reddington got a warm welcome from the Unalakleet crowd gathered in the pre-dawn hours in sub-zero temperatures with a biting wind. His mom was born in Unalakleet, and he still has family here.
It's like a childhood dream, you know, like, coming alive here.
But otherwise, it was all business in the checkpoint. Reddington fired up his cooker for hot water and loaded a big meal that included bacon, beef, kibble, and chicken. And after 10 hours of nonstop mushing, Reddington devoured slices of pizza sent to the checkpoint by fans. He'll need energy for the tight race that's developed after defending champion Brent Sass dropped out Saturday with health problems and early race leader Jesse Holmes' team faded. Reddington had no plans of slowing down.
But if you're going to win this race, you can't sit back and they're not going to hand it over to you.
At the windy Unalakleet checkpoint, he swapped out his big sled for a smaller, lighter sled with no seat. After hundreds of miles along the flat Yukon River and forested interior hills, the Bering Sea coast challenges teams with vast stretches of windy and unprotected trail along the sea ice from Unalakleet to Nome. Originally from Kinnick, Reddington is the grandson of Joe Reddington Sr., who is considered one of the founders of the Iditarod. His three consecutive top 10 Iditarod finishes leading into this year's race have been his best. The two mushers with the best chance of catching Reddington, Kaiser and Deal, each rested their teams on the trail before Unalakleet and stopped at the checkpoint only long enough to grab food for their dogs and a thermos of hot water to stay warm on the trail. In Unalakleet, I'm Ben Matheson.
So after reigning Iditarod champion Brent Sass scratched early Saturday, and later in the day rookie New Hampshire musher Greg Vitello pulled out, as well as Jennifer Labar's scratch about a week ago, there are 30 teams remaining in this year's Iditarod. But there was a close call for Iditarod rookie Eddie Burke Jr. He fell asleep on his sled Saturday between checkpoints on the Yukon River, fell off his sled, and lost his team. As Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports, Burke got some help from his rookie rival, Hunter Keefe.
Iditarod rookie Eddie Burke Jr. had a rough start to his 34th birthday. Early on Saturday, Burke found himself lying on the snow without his dog team in sub-zero temperatures, and he had no way to call for help. Burke and his team had been traveling on one of the longest sections of Iditarod Trail on the hard and fast Yukon River between Grayling and Eagle Island. Then he fell asleep. He recounted what happened next at the Unalakleet checkpoint on Sunday.
And I just dozed off for a split second. My foot slipped off the runner board and hit the snow and just kind of made me stumble and I fell off. And there went my team.
He got off his feet and yelled to them to slow down, but they didn't. Burke estimates he was 18 miles from the remote Eagle Island checkpoint. He had no other choice than to start walking. About an hour later, he says fellow musher Christian Turner caught up to him. Burke says Turner gave him a lift, but only for a few miles.
We went along for a little bit, and he was struggling at the moment, and we decided that it wasn't beneficial for me to be on the sled, you know? But he had a sat phone. He called Mark Norman and got that arranged to have a snow machine come out.
After stepping off, Turner said, Burke says he kept walking until Hunter Keefe's team caught him. Keefe, who was also resting in Unalakleet on Sunday, says it wasn't even a question of whether to offer help.
I didn't really think twice. I let him on because I wouldn't want to be walking at 20 below.
The two top rookies stood on Keefe's sled runners and chatted. Eventually, Burke says he took over the handlebars so Keefe could take a break and sit on the tow sled. Keefe says he enjoyed the company, but he says he also kept his earbuds in and his playlist running.
I had my headphones in, so I'd be talking to him, and then mid-conversation, I'd break into song again.
He sang probably 100 different songs. I got like a full Hunter Keefe concert.
Eventually, a snow machine, driven by five-time Iditarod champion Dallas Stevie, arrived and brought Burke to the Eagle Island checkpoint, where his team was waiting for him. Burke says his dogs are okay, and race rules allow a musher who lost their team to get help from a snow machine as long as they report it to the race marshal. Burke says he was impressed by Keefe's bond with his dogs. Despite their close battle for the prestigious Rookie of the Year honors, Burke and Keefe have forged a tight connection on the trail. Earlier in the race, Keefe says Burke gave him a tip to help his dogs eat better, and it really helped. And Burke has nothing but good things to say about Keefe.
He's just a goofy dude, but extremely nice. Like, it's a very likable guy.
And Burke says, an extremely talented musher. Reporting in Unalakleet, I'm Lex Trinan.
Interestingly, like I said, Burke arrived in Koyuk this morning a little over an hour ahead of Hunter Keefe. Since the Iditarod's Rookie of the Year award goes to the top finishing true rookie, I'm curious what kind of discussions there might be around that honor this year if Burke finishes ahead of Keefe after getting help from Keefe, Christian Turner, and a snow machine. Luckily, Burke's lost dog team was easily found. They just kept running to the next checkpoint. And from lost dogs to lost gear, here's today's listener question.
Hi, my name is Jordan, and I live in Anchorage, and I have a question for the Iditapod. I can't imagine keeping track of so many dog booties and everything else needed for the race. Does anything ever get left behind on the trail?
Thanks, Jordan. And short answer, yes, definitely. As for the booties, with hundreds of dogs, 4 feet each, a lot of those will fall off over 1,000 miles, and mushers send out a lot of extra booties in their drop bags. They'll also look for booties on the trail and scoop them up, whether or not the booties came off their dogs. I'm not sure if this happens on the Iditarod Trail, but here in Anchorage, and I think Jordan probably knows this already, people will often find a stray booty and put it on a stick so it doesn't get buried in the snow. And actually, just the other day, I recovered a booty like that my dog had lost. Somebody popped it onto a tree branch. I came by a few days later. I was biking by, and I just grabbed it without even having to stop. So whoever you are, thanks for that. But what about the other stuff that mushers lose along the way? Maybe some of those more critical pieces of gear. Well, here are some stories courtesy of Lex Trinan, who asked a few of them. Besides sleep, have you lost anything?
Definitely, I just did. I lost my InReach. Yeah, but I picked up Dallas's, so hopefully I'm gonna have some good karma from that and somebody's gonna pick up mine.
How'd you lose yours?
Messing around with it and put it back in my pocket, and then next thing I know, I checked in my pocket and it wasn't there.
That was on the run from Caltech?
Yeah, that was from Tripod over to here. And it was kind of like I was flying along and bumping and bouncing along so good, you know, that it was kind of hard to hang on. And so I was like, man, I need to put this thing away. And I just kind of put it in my pocket too quick and not good enough. And so, yeah, that's the only thing so far.
I've been made aware by race officials at the last checkpoint that I left my leader hook. And
what is a leader hook?
It's a smaller snow hook. So I have my two main snow hooks in the back, but it's a nice little snow hook that you can have separate to tie your leaders out. So now I have to get one of my big ones from the back. But I left it in, I believe, Iditarod, and they're going to hopefully get it to me by Unalakleet. So
how did that happen?
I think I'm like thinking back. I was like getting ready to sign out, and I had taken out off the leader hook, which is good because starting with your leader hook in is a whole nother can of worms and isn't great because your team will try to take off and there'll be a hook holding them down. But I had taken off the hook, hooked up the team, gone back to the sled, and gotten ready to go. And they had popped the hook, and they've done that on me a couple times, and usually when they do that, I don't like to stop again. If they pop the hook to go and want to leave that bad, I just roll with it. So I rolled with it, not realizing that I had not picked up my leader hook yet, so it got left at the checkpoint.
Okay. I did have a ski pole, but I lost it, so if someone finds it behind me, it's my ski pole.
The second ski pole that I've heard has been lost. How'd you lose it?
They get stuck in the snow when you pushing, and if you don't have the lanyard on properly, they sort of rip out of your hand and you can't go back because the dogs are forward.
They're going too fast for you. Yeah. Do you remember where you lost it?
Between Shagluck and here. I don't know where, but yeah, between Shagluck and here.
But it wasn't like you fell. You like remember specifically like pulling and then...
Yeah.
No one's brought it back to you, huh?
Not yet.
Well, I did leave my headlamp at Don's cabin while I was camping. And
where's Don's cabin?
It is 40 miles from Iditarod. So I went from Takotna to Don's and camped. And then I went inside the cabin just for a little bit. I slept outside, but went in the cabin and left my headlamp in there. And then it was daytime, and I was getting ready to leave Iditarod, and it was night, or just about to become nighttime. And I was like, oh, man, I left that headlamp back there, and here comes Matt Hall rolling in and goes, hey, I think you'll need this. Right, so he was kind of a savior on that one.
So you got it back.
I got it back.
How did he know it was yours?
I think my name's on it. And then plus he knew I was the only one camping when he rolled up.
Is this the one you have on? Is that it?
Yep.
Yeah.
That was Jesse Holmes, Hunter Keefe, Christian Turner, and Eddie Burke Jr. Remember, the best way to send us your questions is by recording a voice memo on your smartphone and sending that to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. And another quick note, that InReach thing that Jesse Holmes mentioned, if you don't know, that's a GPS satellite messaging device that Garmin makes. Of course, Burke, the rookie there, getting another major assist, that time from Matt Hall. Rookie or not, even the smartest, big-brained Iditarod dog mushers will lose stuff from time to time bouncing down the trail. The dogs themselves don't have to think too hard about the gear. If a booty falls off, or even the musher, they pretty much just keep on trucking. Still, it can help to have a smart dog on your team. That brings us to the first of our two dogs of the day for today. It's Elway, a dog in Riley Dyke's team, named after famed Denver Broncos quarterback John Elway. Dyke says Elway, the dog, is very athletic and very intelligent.
Yeah, Elway here is kind of my main leader. He's 5 years old. He's one of the few real mature dogs in this team, and he's run. This will be his fourth Iditarod. And
can you describe what he looks like and, you know, his body weight, things like that?
He's a big male, I think 68 pounds, usually 65, 68 pounds, long legs, real athletic, blue-eyed. Yeah, he's a real handsome, good-looking guy. Not super long-coated, but super athletic, and then he's extremely intelligent and kind of always has eyes on me no matter what I'm doing.
Yeah, do you have any stories of situations he's helped you navigate, anything like that?
Well, he actually had him in wheel when we went through that big storm last year through the Topcock Hills, just because it was such strong headwind and he's such a strong dog that when he's in wheel, that sled takes a lot to stop. Like he really keeps it going. I think that's a big reason. I had two really driven leaders up front, but his kind of brawn and back was a big reason we made it through that storm. But really just any scenario on the trail where there's open water, glare ice, overflow, anything like that, he just charges through. He never hesitates at obstacles like that. You know, creek crossings, he'll just leap the creek hole, even when there's a plywood bridge through the gorge and stuff. There's a lot of those that the trail crew puts in, and if it's not a real long gap, he'll just leap the creek rather than go over the bridge. He's really good at crossing water and charging through obstacles.
And when he's not running, what kind of personality does he have at the kennel or at home?
He's mega mellow. He loves being inside. He can be trusted alone in the house for, you know, 8 hours while we're gone, and he'll just lay on the couch and relax. He's not real destructive or anything, so he's real mellow inside, loves being in on the couch, and he spends a lot of his time indoors, sleeps inside a lot, and he's really mellow and relaxed and kind of friendly to everyone.
That was Elway, and for our second dog of the day, we have another smart dog who's maybe not so mellow. Here's Mike Williams Jr. talking about his dog, Viper.
One of my young dogs, he's a two-year-old named Viper. Didn't start leading until the bogus, and I've been running him in lead pretty much ever since, and he's led from the start to here alongside Bandit, but Viper, and he's already taken commands, and that's I love to see that.
And what does he look like?
He's the brown dog up there in lead.
So he looks, the one that's standing up there, is that he looks pretty yeah. Small?
Yeah, small male.
Do you know how many pounds?
Between 45, 50.
Do you know anything about his lineage?
His line goes back to a lot of what my dad was running before I started. And Viper, I got a dog from Dave Turner named Viper, and he got it from Cook. And I bred that. And there's a dog named Draco that I got from Jay Cadzo some years back. And I kind of crossed those dogs into our line.
Okay. Do you remember any other stories about how Viper maybe helped you navigate a tricky situation? Or
Well, it's been a fairly easy trail. We had a couple of creek crossings. One of the bridges in the gorge was broken, and he just jumped right over the creek alongside Bandit. And, you know, he didn't stop and freak out like some young dogs do. But he's just that way. He just takes on whatever's in front of him.
And what's his personality like outside of running?
He's a hyper high energy dog, and he's a pretty voracious eater. He's nice. He's after training runs, he runs constantly, runs around his pole, and he acts like he's always hungry. It's just that kind of dog.
I am also that kind of dog. Mike Williams describing Viper there. Yeah, I think maybe it's time for me to go find some snacks. You can find more of those dogs of the day and their photos at alaskapublic.org/Iditarod, along with all the rest of our coverage of the 2023 Iditarod and past races. That's all for today, though, folks. We'll be back with another full episode of the Iditapod tomorrow, and then maybe we'll even have a winner? And who will it be? Still a tough call. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. Thanks to our Iditapod reporters Lex Trinan and Ben Matheson for sending us all the sounds and the sights of the Iditarod from out on the trail. And thanks to Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon for editorial support. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Thanks for listening, and until next time, happy trails.
I wish I was a dog.